This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines and more of the contemporary art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It's episode 229 with Richard Hudson. He is an English sculptor, however, based in Madrid. And this is part two of three of the Donum Estate Winery series from last month when producer Jennifer Lugris and I attended the essentially grand opening of the Donum Estate's art collection, which is a sculpture collection scattered throughout their winery, including two of Richard Hudson's pieces. So go check out the website, theconversationpod.com. We talk a lot about his sort of blockbuster piece there. It's called Love Me. It's a roughly 26-foot high stainless steel heart, concave, very concave on one side, and then as if exploded through, a large convex protrusion coming out the other side. So as with episode 227 with Douglas White, once again, we get into the process a little bit, but we also, Richard, we take an interesting turn. Richard has had a very unusually romantic and fairy tale-like career as an artist, so you will hear about that in our relatively brief conversation today, but do go check out the website. And on the back end today, I'm going to tell you about, in addition to the Weiss links, which I'll tell you about in a second, I'm going to update you on the Jordan Seiler photo Gicle print that could be yours, as well as one of the four Marcus Sivan artworks. And then with the Weiss links, we will talk about high-stakes gambling, courtesy of Tim Schneider in auction activity, among a couple of other relevant clips. So we sat down with a few folks one afternoon, the grand opening afternoon that Jennifer and I were at the collection's opening, and Richard was the second of the three we spoke with. And if you take a look at that image of he and I in the sort of conference room, you'll see how blindingly lit up it is by the sun. And there's a funny little side note to that, which I'll get to on the back end. So I think that's about it for now. Anything else that you need to know? Just as with the Douglas White episode, just know that every once in a while, you will hear quite a bit of the chatter from the lobby area that kind of filters through into our room and might make it a tiny bit hard to hear on occasions, but for the most part, you should be able to hear everything. So once again, we're going with old school recording equipment, the Snowball Blue mic from the early days of the podcast, what we use currently on the road, which is almost never. All right, let's dive in. Thank you guys very much for being here, and I'll talk to you more on the back end. Congratulations on your efforts. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You must have spent a lot of time here already.
Quite a bit of time, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably, each time I came down, I was here for at least 3 or 4 days each time. And right from the beginning, when it was first muted to do the whole idea with Alan and stuff.
A couple of years ago?
A bit more than that. It's probably about 3 years ago.
Right.
The whole operation took... It took 14 months to make it and sort of bring it here, and then it took another couple of months to put it up. But it was quite an operation.
Yeah, and you got the view of the winery from
there. I know. Well, it's clear. I came here and I spent two days here with Alan, and when he first commissioned the whole thing, which was quite an interesting thing, I sent him a text message saying, "I'm going to be in Beijing next week. Would you like to have lunch?" And or dinner, and he said, yeah, I've got a surprise for you. And I flew over there, and we've met Fabian Frins. He's always represented me and introduced me to Alan. And I went into the restaurant, and I was sitting there with a big grin on his face. So I sat and I said, okay, what's the, you know, the thing? And he said, oh, you know that heart you did with Sotheby's at Chatsworth about 5 years ago with a hole in it? I really like that piece. I want it monumental. I've got this winery which I'm keeping now. I was thinking of getting rid of it, and I want to do sculptures there, and I want it monumental. And I said, oh, what, 2 meters, 1.5 meters? He said, no, keep going, and I'll tell you when to stop. So we got up to 8 meters. He said, okay, that's fine, that's big enough. that's how it will, that's how it will happen.
So he was a collector of yours, and that was how you guys knew.
Yeah, him. He's got a number of my works in Denmark and in Thailand and in China and things like that. And yeah, he's got some works in Hong Kong as well now. With finding the spot to go back to it, we walked around. And I was initially thinking about putting it down somewhere around these buildings. And then when we walked up there for the first time, it was an old picnic site, and there was a bench and things like that. And I stood on it and I said, Alan, this is it. And he stood up there and said, yep, this is it. That's how we decided.
Right. So how high is that piece of
It's that? Eight meters high, it's 8 meters wide, and it's 6.4 meters deep. And it weighs about 16 tons or something.
16 tons?
Yeah, the sculpture does, but there's a lot of tonnage in the ground as
right,
well.
Right,
the foundations.
And then how small was the original piece that he was referring to?
The original piece I first made I made it in plaster, and it was about 50 centimeters high like this. And that was first commissioned. I was asked by Sotheby's to make that at 2 meters to show Chatsworth in polished bronze. And that... did very well, and that's how Alan had seen that in the catalogue, and that's how he saw it.
So how did it go from polished bronze to stainless steel?
Well, I still do polished bronze things, and I just said to Alan, I said, look, and I'd been started working on more stainless, especially with my more new work, in polished mirrored steel, and I said, if you do that in polished bronze, you're going to be polishing it all the time because it oxidizes. Why don't we do it in this, in this polished steel stuff? And he said, yeah. So, that's how that happened.
Right.
So I still make things in polished bronze. And,
right.
And
how does it feel to have made to have pieces with stainless steel? Because it's, it sounds like it's a departure from you to something.
Yeah, it's sort of, I started late. I started when I was 42, being an artist.
Being an artist at 42.
Yeah. And
that's incredible.
I don't think it's old. I think anybody in their life, you decide to do something, you just go and do it, and don't be frightened of it.
Right.
Because I'd hate to spend my whole life doing something I didn't like doing.
What were you doing before that?
My family background is farming. We're farmers. But in the UK, we have this thing of primogeniture. My older brother, he got the farm, all the farm and everything. I just didn't want to just become his employees, as it were. But we're fine, we're friends and all the rest of it. So I went off and started doing sort of property development in London, and I was one of the first people to sort of convert old telephone exchanges into loft building, loft type studios and things. And that went very well, and then in 1990 the market crashed. And I decided then to go on a walkabout to find out what it is I really wanted to do, which lasted about 4.5 years. And I sailed the Atlantic and all around the Caribbean, and we took the boat up the Orinoco, and we lived in the Amazon for a while. And then I left that friend of mine, and I then had another mate of mine, and we bought an old dhow in Cape Town, and we sailed out of all up the east coast of Africa.
You and who?
Another friend of mine,
okay,
who sadly died of malaria, but and we caught fish and bought vegetables in the local market and stuff like that. And so from that, I then started travelling all around Europe again, going up to Latvia when they got their independence and stuff. I ended up on the island of Mallorca, where I met a painter, and I became her muse, her model. And while I was doing that, I was drawing and things, and she started saying, why aren't you doing art? And I suddenly, because I'd virtually run out of money then, I suddenly thought, shit, maybe this is what I should have been doing. And my brother had given me some sculpting tools just before I sort of left on this journey of who I am. I said, this is what I've always felt you should be doing. This was the one thing you loved doing at school, and I thought you were good at it. And putting those two things together, and then a few other circumstances, like a fire in this girl's studio, I helped it get it going again. The guy said, do you want to rent the rest of the building? And I said, how much? And I had to pay him €500 a month in cash. And so I rented it and started work as a sculptor, and made quite a lot of conceptual work to start with, using sort of ready-made objects and things. But I quickly found I really wanted to use my hands and make things out of clay. the plaster and make sort of shapes and things. And the first show I was offered, I'd made three small pieces in clay, and the gallerist said, you know, he looked at my conceptual work and said, okay, let's have that, and that. And he said, but what's this? I said, oh, that's what my new stuff I'm working on. And he said, oh, let's get these cast in bronze. And I said, well, I've never done this before. And he said, well, okay, I'll take you to a foundry. And I said, where? And he said, it's in Madrid. So we got on a plane the next morning and flew to Madrid. And I go into the foundry, and works in there by Patero, and, you know, huge, great thing. And I've got this little thing like this. And anyway, the foundry man was very nice. He said, don't worry, pay me when you sell things. I thought, Christ, what a fantastic deal, as it were.
Right.
And they were each an edition of 7 or 3 pieces. They all sold. And things moved on from there. And now I'm sitting here at dawn talking to you guys with this piece up on the top of the hill.
Well, it does. I mean, the thing that strikes me about all that is the tremendous serendipity. It sounds like your career has had. Do you see it that way?
You know, there's nowhere I can sit in an office and do something. I believe that. I told my sons who are here with me, I said, look, guys, we all have a door over there. And that door over there is there for you. And 99% of people look at that door through their lives thinking, oh, I must go through, I must go and do it. And 0.5% go, they turn, I'll do it next week. You know, they'll turn the handle and they'll go back again. And then the few that jump through that door, boom, I think they make the whole world happen. And that's my philosophy, is like, you've got to get out there. Opportunity will present itself to you. Be aware of it, you know, grab it by both hands when it happens. You know, and I believe in fate and those sort of things. And something told me to go on a walkabout. I was offered a large sum of money to set up a property company and be, you know, the managing director of it. And, you know, and I could have made a huge sum of money in the 90s, you know, during the next property boom. But I'm so thankful I listened to my inner self and went on this walkabout to find out what I really wanted to do. So I do something now that I love doing. Yes, it's up and down. I live off it, you know, I don't have any capital or inheritance and things like that. And I'm making things and, you know, and I love things like that because hopefully that'll be there forever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing that strikes me, though, correct me if I'm wrong, is the sort of frictionless, you know, career motion you've had with your work feels like something that's harder these days, you know? I mean, the congestion in the art world in terms of the number of artists who are, you know, looking
well,
to get ahead.
I can say to you, what bothers me, really bothers me quite a lot, is that, you know, the art fairs jumping up all over the place. And this conceptual movement is just boomed, which, I don't know, I was brought up, you know, an artist is a painter with a brush and a pencil, and a sculptor is somebody who sculpts with their hands and things like that. So there's all this art out there, given the name of art, that you don't have to have any craft skill, you just have to have an idea and have some money, and Fred over there can make it for you, and they'll say, oh, I did that, or, you know, and this is my painting, but you haven't even painted it. And I find that kind of weird, but, you know, doesn't matter. There are people out there that love it, and some of it's great. I love looking at it. It's just got huge, though. And I walk around art, these artists thinking, what, you know, when you see somebody's got a plastic bag on the wall or a, you know, peanut in one corner of the room, you know, and it's got a whole wall of explanations to what it is and what it means. And I'm just thinking, something's going wrong here. So I do feel swamped by the whole movement of art, and it's even moving into the direction of technology, you know, with lighting and virtual reality and, you know, drones and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But that's the way the world is working. It's the way the art has gone. So the traditional painter and the sculptor and things like that is, you know, we're trying to, hi, I'm here, you know. But I believe that, you know, I'm taking on the mantle of Moore or Hepworth and Giacometti and people are making sort of more traditional, making sculptures using, well, polished marine steel is a relatively new thing that people are using. You know, you see it with Anish Kapoor or Koons or stuff like that. But, you know, I still make bronzes, I still make marble works and things like that. So, and it's interesting. And I think that the whole conceptual movement should be given a different title and all that shit. It should be called artfortizing.
Have younger artists come to you though as a as a mentor and whatnot?
Yeah, I feel a bit bad about it. I'm afraid I'm somebody who likes to be on my own in my studio and just work by myself. I can't have somebody around me, because you know, can you? And then you start shaming them or not. I don't know. I like being on my own. And that's the way I am.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Okay.
I'm happy to go somewhere. And I mean, I was invited to the Royal College of Sculpture to judge a competition 2 years ago. But again, I was slightly sort of taken aback because they all know my opinions about art and sculpture and hands-on and craft and things like that. You know, because that piece there was all handmade. We weren't using, you know, modern technology and computers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was all hand-bashed over knuckles, with one guy holding a sheet like this and another guy banging it and then placing it and getting it right. No. And I think it's very sad if we lose these crafts. You know, technology's taken over the human life, the human being, and, you know, good, solid, hard-working labour and things, which has great skills with it, which should be cherished. And, you know, they're dying out. So,
Well, speaking of dying out, you've seen a lot of changes in London, I imagine, over the last couple of decades. I mean, is that something that's disheartening at all?
The last couple of decades, I haven't lived in London. I've really been living in Madrid and Spain. So, and prior to that, was all over the place. But yes, the changes in London are huge. I'd like the authorities there to be more adventurous with their planning, and let's get some artists more involved with buildings and
mm-hmm.
doing some crazy stuff along these blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks, which most people, who wants to go and live in a block? Can't I live in a circle? Can't I live in a triangle or something else? you know, and let's start. You know, they've got the technology to grow gardens up the side of walls and stuff. Give everybody a garden, a patch on the side of your big building, and, you know, start growing some beans off it. And,
do you think Madrid has it right?
Madrid is, you know, they've changed a lot in 30 years. I mean, I shouldn't say the country was quite backwards for a long time, and just then it accelerated forward with Europe, and all that money went pumping into there. And, you know, and it's the old town is beautiful, that's fun, it's great, and all the rest of it. But as soon as you get outside there and you look at the crap that's being built, you know.
Excerpts, yeah. That kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Like around here.
Yeah. It's beautiful around here, I love it.
Well, yeah. Once you... Do you want to come in with that?
I guess I wanted to ask a little bit earlier, when you have mentees that are coming to you, what's some of the advice that you give them?
Don't be afraid of yourself.
I love that.
Don't be afraid, you know, if you have a thought or something that you would like or want to, go and try and do it. You'll only sit on the bench when you're older and think, God, why didn't I do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not a difficult thing.
Is there anything that you thought that you wanted to do that maybe you were a little afraid of or skeptical of?
When I first started out, I wanted to be an actor. And that was my sort of goal, you know, is to sit in front of that big screen, which is not the right attitude to have if you go and train at a theatre school, because I got into a theatre school in England and got thrown out immediately because I said I wanted to be a cowboy in the movies. And I did a couple of films, you know, way back at the beginning, but then my life went on a different direction.
Right.
Things. So it's not a regret. I sometimes think, well, maybe I might actually go and make a film.
It's never too late.
It's never too late. So you might just.
Or you can be a performance artist.
Could be. Maybe. I don't know. I think, you know, there's something I want to say through the medium of film. And maybe, you know, time and the good old money, I might do. I've got a son who's involved in it. So, you know, we talk about doing a collaboration at some point together.
That's a nice connection to have your son Sorry? In the industry. I said that's a nice connection to have.
Yeah. Well, both my sons, you've probably met here, they're both artists.
I haven't.
Oh,
but I will.
They're both artists. And
mm-hmm.
One makes things out of plasticine, and it's hugely successful. And the other one's, he's come, he went into ceramics and studied that in London at St. Vincent Martin's, and then moved into production design and then got involved in movies and things and got fed up with. I think what happened was he was making, because he's a perfectionist, made all these beautiful sets, and then the director would come in and smash it all up straight out, which must be really frustrating.
Yeah.
So he's now come back and he lives up in the wilds of Yorkshire in the north of England, and he's back to doing his ceramics, making wooden pieces, and he's very talented, very talented.
I'm really curious to know what some of the takeaways are of doing the walkabout as extensive as you did. You know,
so your question, what?
The takeaways from doing the walkabout as extensive as you did.
What do you mean by the takeaways?
So in other words, you know, having taken that time off and sort of explored yourself, right? Once you finally sort of settle back, you know, do you find that things, clarity starts to come to you? Does it unfold over a long period of time?
Well, everything started making sense, you know. I remember being told when I was 18, we had a lovely old gardener at home. I loved him. I used to go and work with him and dig the vegetables and stuff. And he said, "Oh, Richard, you're born old." I said, "What do you mean by that?" He said, "No, you academically, I know you're not doing very well and all that, but you have a different knowledge. You have an understanding about life and nature and all those sort of things." And that, he said, it will take time, but as you get older, it will fall into place in the world. And I think it was the inner feeling. Again, take one girl from. What happened? What is money? It's useful for spending, but it doesn't make you happy. The amount of rich people I know are miserable is unbelievable. But so, yeah, no, I found myself by doing this, and just looking and looking and looking, and you know, across this world is so beautiful. The things that are out there to see and do. And yes, maybe I'm a lucky person. I had wonderful parents and grew up on a farm, and you know, and but you know, I've made all my own money and things like that, because I made some money, I was able to then go and travel, but you know, with a rucksack on my back and stuff, and see the world and see life. It's been fantastic, and it's not going to stop. I want to live as long as possible because this is paradise.
What's paradise?
This, the world.
Yeah.
Do we know anything else? I don't. If you can tell me about it, share it to me. But this is paradise. I know, but the, you know, and that's why there's all this awful shit going on around the place, the wars and the this and the that, and, you know, our politicians and blah, you know, but this is paradise, you know, and some people, poor things, are born in horrible situations and everything. God, I want to help them. I just think people say, why are we fighting each other? Why do all these things happen? Maybe it's to create the natural balance in the world, and we wouldn't move forward without this friction going on. But I'd like to think there's another path.
Okay. Well, that sounds pretty idealistic.
I feel like that's kind of what your piece is about, the heart, as
totally.
You were saying earlier.
Yeah. But, I mean, it was I was sitting in my studio thinking, you know, oh, I'll make a harp. You know, I thought, that's a bit boring, you know, just to make a harp. You know, what else could I do with it? And I've been thinking about, you know, the creation of the universe and black holes and stuff. So I thought, well, why don't I, you know, dig a hole in it and write through it? I thought, well, you know, I've seen that somewhere. That's a bit boring. So I started thinking about love and the heart and the male and the female. And then I started thinking about the pregnant mother. So the bump on the outside is the pregnant mother. And obviously, you know, the female's the hole and or the black hole and, you know, and the creation of the universe. And that's how it all came about. And I even thought back then, God, if I can make this and get it out there and start making large versions of it, it could be used as a symbol of peace and love in the world. And so, you know, I've got this gone up here. I've got a 5-meter one going up in Dubai. And I've got other people now talking about other pieces, you know, quite large ones.
Larger than this one?
Sorry?
Larger than this one?
I don't think I can say that.
Well, for all those people in these other cities where it's being made, and for people who don't get to experience this one or others, I noticed walking from the concave side around to the convex one, that it was a very interesting experience, you know, seeing this surprising protrusion and walking under it. And I imagine that there's definitely some kind of metaphor going on.
I mean, it's the only thing I'm slightly uncomfortable with it, in a way, because it's, you know, you see, you look at, you walk up to it and you see the hole and it's like, it all sort of flows. And you walk around it and then there's this bump.
Yeah.
You know, and, but then it's sort of, I don't know, it fits. And then as you, when you, you, as you see when you're close up to it, you get the all of the vineyard and everything reflected in it. And then you work, I mean, at lunchtime I was lucky, I was looking right at it and just seeing it just sort of sitting there up on top of the hill. And now I feel that I'm not with it anymore. It's got itself, it's its own person, it's its own thing.
Right.
And it's found its place and it looks happy up there. And, you know.
Does it communicate to you when you're apart from it?
I think about it, yeah. I think, I've been very, obviously as of bringing my sons here, we haven't seen it before for the first time. There's all those motions going on and watching them have, oh wow, great, oh cool, you know.
Yeah.
That was great, that was lovely, witnessing all that, because, you know, when I finally got it up, it was wow, I don't know, all the rest of it, because there were quite a few headaches that went along, you know, to get it there.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Well, Richard, this has been great talking. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, thank you.
Appreciate it.
And I feel like a hot potato.
Yeah.
Christ!
And need some supplies.
Thank you very much.
Thank
it was
you,
a pleasure.
Nice
thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you again to Richard. And the reason he felt like a hot potato is because he was directly in the sun as we recorded that conversation. Now, here's the funny postscript. Our final conversation, who I will tell you about her, maybe, soon, she figured out that there were probably some controls for the blinds. And indeed, before we started that third conversation, the blinds came down through simple means of a wall switch, and boom, the sun was blocked out. Sorry about that, Richard. But thank you very much for talking to us. Hope you guys found that charming and whatnot. Do let us know what you think. Before we move on to the Weisslings and whatnot, I do want to remind you this is a listener-supported show, and I'm going to tell you about a couple of listeners who have been very generous of late. Doesn't take much to get a little shout-out, guys. It's few and far between. So big thanks to, first of all, Catherine Ruane. I don't know how you pronounce your name. I should have asked you, Catherine. R-U-A-N-E. Ruane, Ran. She has generously stepped up both via PayPal and then Patreon to support the show. So I really want to thank her for that. And I want to let you know that she has a show going on. She's in a group show curated by local big curator, museum director, Andy Campagnone, called Nature Worship. It's at a new space that's called MASH Gallery. It's in downtown LA. The address is 1325 Palmetto, for those of you who want to check it out in the LA area. And the show actually features a couple of alum of the podcast, including Kim Abeles and Samantha Fields, and the title of Catherine's drawing installation. It's a group of drawings on panel, I believe, is Dance Me to the Edge. And the show is up until November 10th. So go check that out if you're in LA. And then I also want to thank another supporter, Dr. Stephanie Kogler-Heimberger, who said that she is keen to get in touch and build a network of people in the arts across the globe, but she also wants more than nice comments. By that, I mean I want exchanges, debates, and all that, just like your podcast, she said. And so her handles, she's growing her following on Instagram, I noticed pretty quickly. Her Instagram handles are at Skogle, that's S-K-O-G-L-E, and then the main one that I've been noticing is at Rupture Work in Progress. That's Rupture Work in Progress. Her Twitters are at Skogle and at Rupture Work. And she told me that her PhD was in art history with a focus on exhibitions of art from Latin America and Latino art in Texas in the 20th and 21st century. And she curated a series of artist residencies in the UK that were fully funded. And that was the best thing I did, she says, better than the PhD. So thank you as well to Dr. Stephanie Kogler-Heimberger. And if you guys would like to support the show, of course, financial contributions are very much appreciated. And to encourage you once again, for those of you who haven't heard the last couple of episodes, there is a piece by Guest Room 228, Jordan Seiler. It's a Giclée print photograph that is 16 by 24 inches, or 24 by 16 inches, I should say, from this year. It's called Collisions Little Peak. You can check that out on theconversationpod.com/support. It is a beautiful black and white photo of one of his advertising interventions. So there's this very sort of austere Bauhausian building in the background, and then in the bus stop in the foreground is one of his interventions in the window for advertising. So I encourage you to bid on that. Goes to the highest bidder, and I think it's a pretty modest amount that we're asking for ultimately. So if you're intrigued or if you have questions, let me know. And of course, there's also, from going back several episodes now, the artworks by guest Marcus Sivin from episode 225. Four artworks. If you bid above $50, you will get first pick. If you go above $30, let's say $35, you will be eligible for second pick, and so on. So there are four pieces. You can check those out on the support page as well. You can also, if you just want to donate, you know, without getting a piece, you're more than welcome. You can donate via PayPal, Venmo, or Patreon. And again, any way that you can support the show financially is very much appreciated. It really does keep the show going. Of course, you can also follow on social media at Artist Podcast. You can leave a review on whatever platform you listen to. iTunes is certainly the classic in terms of traffic and whatnot, and lets other people know about this show and all of that. So thank you very much in advance. And of course, you can simply spread the word to people who don't already know about the conversation. All right, so let's move on to the Vice Links for this near end of October. And once again, Tim Schneider, former very popular guest of this show, writer Tim Schneider of ArtNet, has a piece called High Stakes Gambling from ArtNet, and it goes like this. Last Friday, highly regarded art advisor Lisa Schiff, and this is why I wanted to mention this piece, by the way, Lisa Schiff is yet another former guest of this show. If you haven't heard her conversation, go check it out. So last Friday, highly regarded art advisor Lisa Schiff expressed mixed feelings about the recent auction success of women artists and artists of color, particularly those early in their careers. While she says she would rather see the buy side spending bands of cash on these types of deserving works than the likes of Cause, Schiff, that's K-A-W-S, by the way, Schiff says she nevertheless finds it, quote, a little annoying, unquote, that short-term speculators are partly responsible for these otherwise just results. What most caught my interest in Schiff's op-ed, though, is the similarities it reveals between the art market and the financial markets regarding two different vectors of worth. Like many others, Schiff sees long-term danger for artists whose auction prices outstrip their gallery prices too soon. Underlying her fear is her faith in, quote, the traditional mechanisms of value making, in which criticality is linked to the market, unquote. An art market linked to criticality, of course, means one in which a small number of industry experts, gallerists, institutional curators, even scholars and critics, are considered the best judges of intrinsic value. Auctions, on the other hand, are a much freer marketplace, one without any artificially imposed caps, where the potential buyers determine the price based on how much they perceive art to be worth. Weirdly, this is a similar dichotomy to the one you find on Wall Street between valuation and what's called price discovery. Valuation seeks what an asset is actually or intrinsically worth based on objective measures. Price discovery, on the other hand, is just a matter of buyers and sellers reaching an agreement about what an asset is worth in the heat of consummating a deal. Nice language, Tim. This means value can be wildly different from price and vice versa. Recognizing the difference between the two is, in theory, one way to get rich enough in finance to be able to spend stupid amounts of money on artwork. In a sense, Schiff's argument is that a criticality-driven primary market reflects something like intrinsic value, and the auction market only reflects crude prices. But her problem is that those towering auction prices cast a long shadow over the expert's judgment of value. Suddenly, everyone involved with a young artist feels pressured by the market to make the value match the price and scale up production and exposure to match the attached expectations. And then all hell can break loose. For a memorable example, watch this candid TEDx talk by former market supernova Lucian Smith, who tells how his dizzying early success in the zombie formalism boom eventually led him to a rock-bottom reckoning that involved locking himself in a public restroom to contain his violent urges after his substance abuse as coping mechanism culminated in a, quote, hell on earth night of smoking PCP. I'm not suggesting a straight line between outsized auction success and this kind of horror show. But I am suggesting that, when it comes to young artists, there can be more at stake in the tension between value and price than who makes money. So that's again from alum Tim Schneider on ArtNet, and for a much shorter and sweeter, well, maybe not sweeter, piece related to wealth and collecting. This is from CNBC/ArtNet. A billionaire's tips for collecting blue chip art. Hedge fund manager and museum founder J. Tomlinson Hill shares insights on how to build a top-notch art collection. The billionaire's tips include finding out who else buys work by artists you are interested in and using databases to learn about artists' values, as you would when buying stocks. Frankly, however, it seems like he left out the first important step: become an actual billionaire. And finally, for a nice light ending, Deller creates a monumental party for Stonehenge centenary. This is from The Guardian UK. A century after Stonehenge was gifted to the nation, a very British sort of celebration is being curated by the artist Jeremy Deller, including a chance to leap around on his life-size inflatable version of the monument. Sacrilege, Deller's irreverent, rubbery incarnation of the monument, has toured the globe, but is being blown up for the first time on the Stonehenge site for a pleasingly eccentric anniversary party that begins on Friday. I believe that's today. He says there is no reason why a visit to Stonehenge should not be lighthearted as well as awe-inspiring. Quote, it's a very significant site, but there's no reason why you can't have fun with it and enjoy it, he said. He is keen to see Sacrilege, which made its debut at the 2012 Glasgow International Festival of Visual Art, juxtaposed with the real Stonehenge. And that's all the Stonehenge we have for this week, for this episode. Thank you guys very much for listening, as always, and for your support in advance. Much appreciated. And I will talk to you in a couple of weeks after the election has unfolded. God help us all. As former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich titled his most recent email via MoveOn.org, I am extremely worried. Cross your fingers, folks, and go fucking vote. All right, I'll talk to you in a couple weeks. Ciao for now.